Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
The command post in the HKL is on the Belmonte Casino Road. The enemy is in the mountains above us. We've taken up residence in a wine cellar. You can't move outside the bunker during the day. The cellar is pitch black. So we live like rats by candlelight for 8 weeks. The room is small. We've done a lot of work to make it bulletproof. The enemy are Moroccans, wild. The remnants of my battalion are lying to the right and left of the command post in shot-up houses. There are about 80 men. Our bunker is damp, and when it rains, it's full of groundwater. We have mice, lice, ants, and even more vermin as flatmates. 8 weeks locked away in a nasty cellar hole don't go by without a trace, especially when everything is filled day and night with the roar and crash of the shells. You're happy when the day is over. You're happy when the night is over. You want to forget. You don't want to think anymore. You don't want to hope. You don't want to despair. Eternal restlessness torments you. If it's quiet, you want noise. If it's noisy, you want it quiet. Day and night creep along, and you don't know why. We know each other better than we know ourselves. We know every idiom, every joke, every curse, every idiosyncrasy. Indeed, every thought. Only the food carriers bring variety and mail, the only joy of the day. We look for something to do. We played cards. We tried our hand at poetry. We read good and bad things. We sang pop songs or serious songs. We told each other stories. That's how we try to pass the nights. During the day, we lie down. We can't sleep anymore, and if we succeed, then the lice come out. And when things get really bad, we have to use the schnapps. Once we've drunk it, we curse about the booze, a natural consequence. We don't care about anything except our loved ones at home. Wow, that was Major Jörg Zellner, who we've met before in this series, commander of the 3rd Battalion of the 134th Regiment, part of the 44th Hocken Deutschmeister Infantry Division. And he's only got 80 men left, and that's with some replacements. I mean, that's about as grim as it gets, isn't it?
How many should he have, you know, with a...
Well, a battalion, 900?
Yeah.
900, yeah.
There we go. So he's operating at sort of 8%. Something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Sort of 8 to 10%.
Welcome, everyone. Achtung, and welcome to this episode of The Race to Rome. Episode 5, I believe, we're on now, of a 4-part series.
Or the slow drudge to Rome.
Exactly.
I actually think we should just call it Rome 44.
Well, or the road to Rome, something like that. I mean,
Road to Rome, 1944.
The thing is, we did, this was going to be 4 episodes, and here we are in part 5, and it's, I mean...
It's probably going to be 7.
It's metaphorical, isn't it? It's the whole... Everything's metaphorical these days.
But... Too much metaphorical.
Too much bloody metaphor. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Puts it all in perspective.
So, too much perspective, Jim. What we have here, though, at the end of the last episode, the question that we dangled before you, dear listener, was what if the Germans counterattack? What if they counterattack? And, well, if you're even the sort of most thumbnail student of the Second World War, you know that the one thing the Germans can't help but do is counterattack. They just can't help themselves. They have to. It's completely boiled into everything they do, is they will counterattack. Even if their battalions are operating at 8% strength, they will counterattack.
You mustn't counterattack. No, I have to. I must counterattack.
I have no choice.
I have no choice. The Führer says I must. I have to.
It is my instinct. I have no other options.
It is part of my DNA.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing. So when we talked in the last couple of episodes, we talked about, you know, the build-up at Anzio and how the Anzio front for the Germans goes from 800 people to 90,000. Not overnight, but as near as damn it in terms of military build-up. And then at Cassino, it goes from thinly held to slightly better. But given the terrain and all that sort of thing, you just need to fill Cassino up with enough MG42s and no one's getting through easily. But it's at Anzio where there is a proper German full-blooded counterattack to come? Because there's been the battle at the factory when British battalions have been sliced up.
Not possibly given quite the armour support they might have done.
That they might have needed and all that sort of thing. So here we are, background of Fishfang, ladies and gentlemen, because of course the
great,
Germans...
Great name. I have dangled this in front of Paul Davis, by the way, as a potential beer mat stroke T-shirt.
It's a good name, Fishfang. Does it mean fish tooth? Does it mean, you know, the vicious fangs of a tooth?
No,
of a fish?
It means fish...
Or trap a fish or something.
Yeah, trap, yeah.
Okay. That's not quite as exciting as the idea that it's...
Yeah, but it sounds good.
It just sounds great. They're good at that. The Germans are pretty good at that. By the way, I'm managing to get Fal Gelb into my current stand-up show. And I had Steve Prince came on Friday and he emailed me this morning saying, congratulations, I never thought I'd see anyone mention Fal Gelb in a... stand-up stage show.
I've got to say, it's noticeable that the pub landlord's knowledge of Second World War has increased in recent times.
Anyway.
He obviously read a load in lockdown, didn't he?
He did. He read a lot. Well, he listened to this podcast. So he's one of our keenest listeners. So Fishfang, von Mackensen has 91,837 soldiers in preparation at his disposal, 58,189 of whom are combat troops. And that's an interesting teeth to tail ratio, isn't it? The Allies, it would probably be the other way around, wouldn't it?
Yes, yeah, no, substantially. But it's interesting to think. I mean, I'm trying. What I do need to do is work out how many combat troops there are on the casino front at this time, and I would say you'd be struggling to put it at more than can't be 20,000. I mean, just can't be.
Blimey. Yeah. Blimey. Gosh.
You know, there's hundreds on Monte Cassino only.
Yeah.
And all these divisions are kind of sort of between 10 and 20%, apart from the 5th Gebirgsjäger Division, the 5th Mountain Division, which is about 50%. So that's like 7,500. You know, I mean, it can't be much more than that. Anyway, but it's amazing, isn't it, that so much emphasis has been put on Anzio because Hitler has said the abscess must be lanced, must be thrown back into the sea.
But if you're a Hitler who's framing everything through this sort of dramatic prism, throwing people back into the sea is a much more exciting and also politically juicy. You know, that's a big defeat rather than holding them up at casino, whatever. It's not as symbolic, is it? Whereas if you repulse an invasion, throw them back into the sea, I mean, they might think twice about D-Day, you know.
Well, that's exactly his thinking. That is exactly his thinking. And it's interesting because at this stage, Kesselring is really optimistic, as he always is. And he's thinking, okay, great, well, we'll do that. And then we'll move down the coast and we'll sort out the Garibaldi front and we'll unfold the American position of the Fifth Army position by cutting in behind, back across the Garigliano. Then we'll take it from there, we'll fold up the whole thing, and then we'll win back the whole of Italy. And it is absolute la-la land stuff. I mean, total fantasy. And interestingly, although we were sort of joking about the Pavlovian response of Germans to counterattacking whenever they're attacked, the one person who's not incisive but interested in this is von Mackensen, who is the Eberhard von Mackensen. And actually, it's worth Googling his father, who's a splendid-looking fellow with a massive, great kind of bearskin hat with skull and crossbones on and a massive moustache. That's his dad, the old man, and a field marshal. So Eberhard von Mackensen is by this stage very disillusioned with the Hitler, doesn't like him at all, thinks the whole thing that, you know, they're going to lose, this is a complete waste of time, and is still absolutely determined that the way to fight the war in Italy is to go to the Pisa-Rimini line, the Gothic line, and sit behind there and cut your supply lines and just hold up there and have a fight a defensive war and forget all this counterattacking nonsense, which he's pretty sure, having been on the ground and been around the Anzio area, is not going to go particularly well because the ground is so waterlogged. And that means that you're canalized in your use of your armor. The only chance of making a breakthrough is if you can bring your armor to bear. You won't do it with just infantry alone and artillery. And they haven't got, they might have lots and lots of guns, but they don't have as much ammunition as the Allies. And the ground is not good. The going is poor. And so he's not very optimistic about it.
I can see how this conversation goes, though. General Mackensen, you do not have the will and the belief required for this job. That's where that ends up, doesn't it?
Yeah. And what does von Mackensen say? Jawohl, mein Führer.
Of course he does. Because he might be, you know, if he's not one thing, he's not a fool.
He's a splendid-looking fellow. He's got a very shaved side of his head and a monocle. And he's got a permanent scowl.
I mean, has anyone ever actually needed a monocle? That's the question.
Wow, I don't know. Because, I mean, if you need one, you need two, don't you?
Exactly. That's exactly my point. Get some glasses. Unless it's just for reading, isn't it? It's the idea that it's just for reading. You squint for the reading and then you're back. I don't know. Anyway, so he has two core. So he has...
Which obviously is more than the Allies have because they've only got one core. They've got six core.
They've got six core. Yeah. So that's... the thing is, it's not 3-1, though, is it?
No, it's almost 1-1.
Exactly. And, you know, the rule is, isn't it? Unless you apply the 3-1 locally, you know, which is the way to do it, concentration of force,
yep.
You know.
Well, there definitely is that going on. I mean, you know, they definitely, you know, the localised area. This is a very concentrated attack still, Fish Fang.
So he's got lots of people. He's got tigers and he's got all sorts of stuff, hasn't he?
He's got 45 battalions. He's got 452 artillery pieces, which is 20 more than the Allies.
Yeah, he's got the Hornets as well.
He's got the Hornets.
I don't think we've ever talked about Hornets before.
We've never talked about the Hornet. I was so happy when I read about it and discovered that we could bring in the Hornet. Bring up the Hornet. That's the new line. Yeah, so they've got Hornets. And Hornets, for those who don't know, are a Panzer Mark III chassis, which in the big scheme of things is quite small, with a massive, great 88mm Pack 43 on top and sort of armoured side. So they do look properly like an assault gun.
Well, they look, I mean, it looks like a Panzer III with an appalling hard-on, basically, doesn't it? That's the truth.
but when you see a picture of it, you will go, oh, that's a Hornet.
Yeah, exactly. So he's brought some heavy metal. His problem as ever, though, is that it's all scraped together.
These are all orphan units.
Yeah, exactly. And he might have a lot of guns, but he's not got that much ammo. And also the Allies, although it's winter and we've talked about the issues that the Allies have with bringing their air power to the party, is that the Allies have air power on their side. So you can have, you know, a flat gun on a Panzer III, but if you can't point it to the sky.
Yes. the other problem about the weather is that it's a double-edged sword because low cloud means you're not going to get hammered by the Allied air power. But on the other hand, it also means that it's probably going to be very wet, in which case your ability to go across a only recently drained salt marsh in Tiger tanks is going to be problematic, which weigh 56 tons. You know, it ain't going to happen. And the other problem is that his divisions are really, really depleted. So, yes, there is Kampfgruppe Pfeiffer, which is based around the 65th Infantry Division, which was entirely destroyed back at the end of November 1943 on the Adriatic and remade. So some important replacements have come. So 900 replacements have come to the 65th Infantry Division, 850 for the 26th Panzer, and 650 for the 3rd Panzer Grenadier. But these guys are all just kind of like, right, there you are, you go to that unit, okay, just sort it. And you're expected to kind of bed in. Don't forget, these replacements are all placements at this stage of the war coming in with literally no training whatsoever. I mean, it's literally basic 6 weeks. Off you go. And it's not enough. Kesselring has asked for extra support. He's asked for the Panzer divisions and various other more armour. He doesn't get it, but Hitler does send the Lehr Infantry Regiment, which is like a sort of brigade. And this is made up of kind of instructors who you'd have thought should be instructing rather than being sent to Anzio. And Hitler has great, you know, he's very impressed with the Lehr Infantry Regiment, has high hopes for them. And he also sends him a load of exciting new gadgets, such as the Goliath, which is this little sort of mini tank, remote controlled tank full of explosives. And it's tiny. I mean, it's like a sort of suitcase on tracks.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone who knows their German tank tech, and that's an awful lot of people, thanks to sort of the kind of top Trump's attitude to tanks and stuff. The Goliath is like one of those things you know, it's what is it, wire controlled? So it can only go as far as the cable and off it goes.
A mortar shell comes in.
And it, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, mortar shell goes, it cuts the wire.
Cuts the cable, end of story. But the idea is it poddles up to whatever you're you want to demolish, and then you blow it up.
Yes. I mean, the general consensus of German troops about the Goliath is that it's a complete waste of time. And again, the whole problem with orphan units is that people don't know each other. There's, you know, this is a problem we've kind of constantly, you know, taken from Peter to Phil Paul, is that you've kind of got all these units. You have there is none of that. There's iron discipline, of course, but there isn't that kind of mutual trust, which is what you really need to go forward. You need to know that commander and know that they're making the right decisions. Otherwise, you tend to kind of sort of falter and prevaricate. So that's a problem. There's also arguments about what should happen, because von Mackensen wants a broad front attack, which is absolutely the right way to go, I think, on this particular instance, because there are multiple roads and you want to be attacking them all at once so that the Allies can't concentrate their artillery against you. Because the problem is if you're in a concentrated form going all down the Via Anzate, which is that road that goes from Anzio straight to Albano, to pretty much dead straight north, then you become a nice big fat target. But Hitler goes, no, it's all got to be down the Via Anzate because that's where the best road is for armor. Like, yeah, okay, but there's some quite good roads coming from kind of Cisterna to Conquer and from Littoria and all sorts of other areas. So you know, the idea that that's the only road is simply not the case, but... Hitler also wants a creeping barrage. He says, I want a First World War era creeping barrage. Everyone goes, but we haven't got the ammunition for that. So they just go, yes, mein Führer, and just ignore it.
It's fascinating this because, you know, this is a, you know, one of the things that people know about Hitler is the micromanagement. And here it really absolutely is in full effect. And that these generals, I mean, after all, although, let's be honest now, one of the things a lot of the generals said after the war, wasn't it? Is like, if only we'd been allowed to fight the war the way we'd wanted, we'd have won it. And he kept meddling and he kept buggering up for us. And, you know, if only the Fuhrer had left it to the professionals, we'd have won, which is very interesting because that idea in a peculiar way has gone down with some sympathy in the West or did after the war, didn't it? In a kind of weird sort of your little hearts were kind of like, yes, if only the generals had been allowed to fight, the Germans would have won. So they, wait, what?
Yeah.
Why are you so keen on that idea?
Yeah, it's absolutely nonsense, isn't it?
Well, it's nonsense. And when you look at the situation they're actually in, sure, maybe Mackensen, if he'd been left to his own devices, could have, in this set of circumstances, could have come up with a different result to start with. But in the end, how many aircraft does the Mediterranean Air Force have at its disposal?
Well, 12,500.
Well, there you go. So
enough said. Rest my case. QED.
Exactly. Yeah. You can tinker around with rolling barrages or not, or which road you're coming down. You know.
But at the end of the day, it doesn't add up to a hill of beans in this crazy world because it's not enough.
Exactly. You're going to get served your full English at some point by the other side, is the thing.
Well, put it this way, there's absolutely no way that the Allies would attack with this level of...
No. Well, there you go. That is a really good metric for it. Although...
Wouldn't even consider it.
Avalanche, 1-1. Avalanche, they didn't have the 3-1, you know. We've talked about the risk at Avalanche before, but that's an air power. But that's the air power quotient. If you've got the air power... The force multiplier of air power is, or it's
no. They have got 3-1. They've got a 3-1 on landing because they've got they're up against the 16th Panzer Division and they are landing three divisions. So they have. It's not enough for an attack, but I do know what you mean. Yeah.
So anyway, so Hitler's done his meddling. He's tweaked the plan,
and he also insists that the Lehr Regiment are in the initial advance, even though the poor bastards have only just turned up and don't know the lay of the land at all. We don't need to, mate. Just go down that road. See that road there? Yeah, that's the one. I mean, it's bonkers. But what you've got now is the British who were covering entirely, the British 1st Division who were covering entirely the Via Anzate and created that finger, that bulge, that salient going up to Campiglione Station, which included Aprilia, the factory. They have now been shoved over to the they're depleted and they've been shoved over onto the western left-hand side of the Via Anzata as you're looking north. And the Via Anzata is mainly held by the 45th Thunderbirds Division, with 56th Division on the immediate west-hand side and 1st Division in reserve. So that's how you've got, and what you've got astride the Via Anzata, and this is one of the great stories of the whole Anzio battle, is you've got Company E of the 2nd Battalion of the 157th Infantry Regiment, which is one of the three infantry regiments in Thunderbirds, commanded by Captain Felix Sparks. And when you're imagining a grizzled, square-jawed American officer with looking exactly like Ronald Spears in Band of Brothers, chewing on a stogie, that's Sparks.
God damn it, you guys. Get up there.
One of those blokes.
Get your ass up there.
Yeah, it's one of those.
Right, yeah, okay.
That's him. And then you've got Company E out front on the straddling the Via Anzate, just south of Caracetto, which is this little kind of hamlet just south of the factory. Then behind him, either side, you've got Company F and Company G, but they're sort of staggered. They're like a sort of, think of a Vic of three Spitfires. That's what it's like. So they're there, and they've also been issued with two M10 tank destroyers and one 57mm anti-tank gun. And so it begins, 4 a.m., 16th of February, 1944. Opening barrage by the Germans, followed by infantry and assault guns.
Is it a creeping barrage? Do they do that?
No.
So they fob the Führer off. So already, if this all goes wrong, he can go, I told you to do a creeping barrage. And they're like, well, yeah, but, you know,
yeah,
sorry,
yeah,
boss.
Yeah, exactly. You can see where that's heading, can't you?
And so they come straight out. They come straight out the mist on top of Easy Company, led by Captain Felix Sparks. And he has a radio. He doesn't have a FOU, a forward observation officer, but he has a radio. So he does direct fire back, not onto their batteries, but onto the attack. So he's not doing counter-battery fire. He's actually dealing with a German counter-attack.
Mm-hmm. He does it very effectively.
And what happens to the layer? They cut and run. They're sod this.
They go, got on Himmel, I'm out of here.
I.E. American Schweinhund, got on Himmel, and they're out of there.
There's lots of that going on. Kamerad.
All that.
There's definitely the acrid sense of cordite. There's the buzz of machine guns. There's all that. The ceaseless chatter of machine guns. It's literally ceaseless all day.
Okay. God. And what happens to the? I mean, so what then happens? Because I mean, the Germans keep pressing the attack, though, right? I mean, just because the layer have had enough, right?
Yeah. So the old hands of the 715th, who've been in theatre for at least 3 weeks, and the 65th Infantry, who've been reborn but twice. They know the form, and they start doing their infiltration. And basically, they just push on. They're getting pretty badly hammered, the Germans, because they're exposed and it's obvious. And you know, machine guns. You know, this is where these heavy machine guns that they do have are really good. Which are the water cooled Brownings, and they just go. I mean, it's like Maxim gun stuff, and they just keep going all day. You can just keep firing them. There's no barrel change required or anything like that.
Yeah, it's just the belt. That's all you got to do.
Yeah, all you got to do. And they manage to sort of, they hang in there. But what happens as darkness falls, because don't forget, this is February still, and it's dark, and it gets dark sort of, you know, second half of the afternoon, quite early on. They start to infiltrate from the sides, either side. So they don't go down the Via Anzati. They've got Stugs and stuff, and they've also got those rather crap Italian assault guns, which look like Stugs, but less powerful. And they've got those.
Is it the Severmente? Is that what it's called?
Yes, that's exactly what they are. That's exactly what they've got. They've got loads of those. And the infantry infiltrate around the sides and cut in behind kind of Company Fs and G, who start to fall back, which means that by daylight, because von Mackensen urges his men to keep going through the night. And it's really interesting because there's this reputation in Northwest Europe that the Germans don't like night fighting. They don't do night patrols. They do night patrols, but they don't do night fighting. They don't do night attacks. They do all the time in Italy because, of course, it's winter and it's dark, so they're used to operating in the dark, which is probably one of the reasons why the Lehr regiment aren't quite so up for it, because, you know, they come from Berlin and that's not what they taught. But these guys are kind of, you know, there's a cadre of people who know about this stuff. So they do infiltrate through the night, and, you know, and you can imagine what a kind of sort of infantry on infantry is, sort of, you know, flashes and flares going off and all the rest of it. You know, people don't really know what the hell's going on. And it's very confusing and very difficult to kind of find out what's what. Anyway, the long and short of it is they make quite big strides in that first night. But at the end of the day, you know, their attacks elsewhere, this is the main attack. They've, you know, for example, the attack on the 3rd Infantry Division, which is further to the east, gets absolutely nowhere whatsoever. And by the end of the day, on Fischfang Day 1, there's kind of recorded casualties for the Germans are 324 killed in action, 1,207 wounded, and 146 missing, which isn't that much in the big scheme of things, but it's still kind of, you know, you're getting on for kind of 2,000, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, 1,600, 1,700.
That's not good.
You know, if you're attacking force when you're kind of quite short, it's not great.
When you've had 900 replacements here, 850 there, 650 there, that's you've kind of burned those off in the initial simmer, haven't you?
But I also think the analysis on the losses is more sinister, which is our heavy losses were due to insufficient training of troops, heavy enemy artillery fire, frequent fighter attacks, and enemy sniper activity. Yeah, you know, all of that. And insufficient training of troops is getting a real, real problem at this stage. And I think I think once your army has, your army training has collapsed, you've got a big problem on your hand, because it means mount attacks. Because the moment you're doing an attack is a complicated, coordinated thing. Whereas sitting in a trench or a foxhole isn't. You've just got to sit there and fire a machine gun and keep firing mortars. And the rest of your troops, all they've got to do is ferry ammunition from, you know, mortar rounds and machine gun rounds. And the defensive war is a war of engineers laying mines and booby traps and all the rest of it. And it's one of machine guns and mortars. And you don't need an awful lot of men to do that. And you don't require a huge amount of training.
Well, and what you don't need is people who know how to take and create initiative.
That's a very, very good, very good point.
There's the defender's initiative, isn't there? Which is that all he has to do is defend. You know, obviously you watch your flanks and you watch your fields of fire and all that sort of stuff. But you don't have to take the initiative. So your men don't need. You need someone like Felix Sparks. Go, you goddamn guys, hold on, right?
Yeah.
But you don't need that level of initiative, do you? Anyway, so that's gone very, very, very badly. We'll take a very quick break, and then we'll look at some consequences on the ground for the Allies that may surprise some of you.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, where during the break, during the interval, we've realized that this battle is going to grind on far longer than we imagined. Right? I'll be honest with you, ladies and gentlemen. We have Jim's incredible notes in front of us, and we're only on Fish Fang Day 2, when we really, according to the battle plan and the schedule, we should be in situation end of February, and we're not.
Well, can I just point out that when we do get to Operation Diadem in about 3 years' time... six episodes of time, then you will realise that the best laid plans and all the rest of it, that even that took a lot longer than everyone anticipated. As always. But I think this is all juicy stuff, and it's not one to rush, and there's plenty to say, and why wouldn't we do it?
But Fishfang, regardless, something happens that has been bubbling under, that really, those, if you've been following this campaign closely, you've probably been thinking at some point they're going to have to do this. And that's Alex and Clark get together on the 16th of February.
The same day that Fishfang is launched.
The same day that Fishfang's launched. So these things, are unrelated in a way, this decision and Fishfang. Because, you know, Fishfang's going to happen, isn't
well,
it?
Also, the Allies know that Fishfang's going to happen because prisoners of war have revealed it. And it's completely obvious. You know, on a big flat plane like Anzio.
Yeah, what else are you going to do?
Really, what else can you do? You can't hide it. So they know it's coming. So they're all ready for it. So this is a kind of... On the meeting of Alexander and Clark on the 16th of February is, we know Fishfang's underway now, but really this is, you know, the leadership of Sixth Corps is not working out how we had hoped. And the sensitivities here, because Alexander is British, the Sixth Corps commander is American, so is Clark, obviously the commander of the Fifth Army, and there's some sensitivities here. So Alex is very keen that John Lucas, the commander of Sixth Corps, should be given the tic-tac, but doesn't want to be kind of too kind of heavy-handed about it.
Doesn't want to push it. Yeah. So Alex wants to fire him, but knows he can't push it too hard because, well, I mean, he needs Clark to sort of, it's leadership by consensus, isn't it? He needs Clark to agree with him, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But fortunately enough.
Clark does.
He does.
Yeah.
He does. And, you know, there is a huge amount of pressure on both of them at this point. I mean, for those of you who've listened to the first few episodes, I mean, what you'll realise is that all of this has been happening in a massive rush. There's this pressure of time. There's a tyranny of overlord. There's the problems of shipping, landing ships, these crucial, most crucial of all assault vessels that have to leave the theatre by a certain date. And, you know, can we all do it all and get through to Rome quickly enough? And there is an imperative to get to Rome so that you've got this buffer above the Foggia airfields and blah, 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 and all that. And at the same time, you know, Churchill is sending little missives to Alexander, sort of, you know, saying, I thought this was supposed to be a cat claw and it's more like a beach whale and all this kind of stuff. So you've made this point numerous times. Politics always, always, always gets in the way of military decision making. And this frustration of the lack of aggressiveness in Anzio is starting to sort of bubble over.
Jim, this is different, though, because in the summer in Normandy, this kind of political pressure starts to create itself, doesn't it? Things are going too slowly in Normandy.
Well, because the Allies are never going as fast as everyone back in looking at the maps wants them to. And that's because warfare is an incredibly difficult thing. You know, the enemy has a vote, as you've also constantly said, and unexpected things get in the way. And you can only plan on your best assumptions and with the resources you've got to hand. And they're never, the resources are never, they're always kind of two-thirds of what you want them to be.
Yeah. So Alex asks Ike for, I mean,
he goes to Ike, you know, because Ike's his mate, and this is all, you know, this is all so wrapped up with Overlord and preparations for Overlord. And, you know, he wants his advice, and he knows that Ike's got the ear of Marshall, who's the, you know, chief army guy in the US, actually in charge and all the rest of it. So he says, you know, the problem is that, you know, they're negative and lacking the necessary drive and determination. They appear to have become depressed by events. And when he says they, he's talking about Lucas, but he's also talking about the general sort of tone of malaise, which is, you know, and there's no question about it that there's a kind of besieged kind of defensive attitude of Sixth Corps. And, you know, you can understand it with the whole of 14th Army sort of massed around you. But, you know, Eisenhower even suggests that he could have, because Alex says, you know, what we really need is a thruster like Patton. And he's not suggesting Patton, but he's saying, you know, we need, that's the kind of the cut of jib that we need. And Ike says, well, look, you know, I can lend you Patton for a month if you want, but I would prefer not to, but we could do this. And Alex talks to Clark about this. And obviously, there'd be all sorts of awkwardness about Patton serving under Clark.
Yeah.
Even though he has already in North Africa. Yeah. It's just a bit tricky. It's not really a goer. And Clark goes, no, I want to promote Truscott, who is more of a kind of thruster in his approach. And he says, look, I agree with you that Lucas has to go, but there's, you know, we're in the middle of a battle. I don't think this is the time to do it. I think what we'll do instead is let's make Truscott his deputy. And Alex goes, yes, and let's bring in Vivian Eversley, who is ex-5th Division commander, and he can act as the British deputy. So you've got two deputies. And that means there's a sort of general shift around of command. So John O'Daniel, who is known as Iron Mike, and he's the kind of sort of, you know, the ultimate sort of gung-ho GI commander, he takes over 3rd Division, and Bill Darby, who's had his Ranger battalions lost at Cisterna on the 30th of January, takes over the 179th Infantry. So the die is cast for Lucas, although he's not actually sacked at this point. The decision is made, but he hasn't quite been given his P60.
They're doing this anyway. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting about this. This isn't a crisis response to Fishfang at all. This is a response to the bigger picture, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a point to the bigger picture, and it's a response to the fact that you know, the source of, and it's not just that he didn't go all out for the Colli Lazzali in the first days. It's because he's got this defensive mindset. He spends most of his time in a bunker, which has been carved out of a sort of, you know, the limestone underneath Nettuno. He's not very visual. He doesn't go around the front very much. He's all about defense and about building up stocks. He hasn't used his incredibly impressive armor that he's got, and is showing no signs of aggressiveness whatsoever. And he's ponderous, and, you know, and he has this unfortunate look of, you know, he's only 52, but he looks about 60. And you know, he's not inspiring. He's not motivating people. He's not encouraging an aggressive mindset. He's not a Patton, but he's not a Truscott either. You know, and what one always has to remember with American commanders is actually their time in the front line is comparatively short still, even at the beginning of 1944. And it takes time to work out who's who and who can cut it. And, you know, who's been good back in the US in the training days is not, you know, and who's a really good staff officer is not necessarily a really good frontline soldier. They're going through exactly the same thing that the British Army did in the first 2 years of their, you know, of the war, you know, for up to and beyond the fall of France and Dunkirk and everything. You know, that's why all those desert generals are getting sacked.
But although with air superiority, so they have less of the disadvantages that the British generals had in that first 2 years of the war. I think it's fair to say.
Yes, I think that's true. But you're kind of, I suppose what I'm really saying is, you know, it's not until you've really tested commanders that you kind of know how they're going to fare. And, you know, generalship is a really, really difficult and challenging business. And all the language of Lucas in his diary suggests
who'd
that someone
be a general?
Who's feeling...
That's what he said. Who'd be a general?
Yeah, who'd be a general? You know, he's feeling browbeaten, exhausted, stubborn, you know, very defensive. They keep saying I should be doing this, but, you know, I'm just trying to get myself in order. I think I've actually done a really, really good job. So also kind of sort of horrible whiff of complacency as well. I mean, you know, Lucas is a really, he's a good guy. You know, he's humane, he's decent. If you sat around him for dinner, you'd think he was great company. But commanding Anzio, no, he's not up for it. But he's not as bad as some.
Well, there we are. There we go. So Fishfang, day two. The Germans do fight at night for Fishfang Day 2, the night of the 16th, 17th. Further infiltrations. Easy Company totally surrounded.
This is so bizarre. Okay, so the whole thing about Easy Company is so weird because what they do is in the morning they're totally surrounded, but they manage to pull back to a kind of little low hill. And when we talk about low hill, we're talking really low. I mean, this is like a slightly bit of raised ground off the plain on the western side of the Via Anzati. So what you've got the Via Anzati, east of the Via Anzati, it is just flat as a board. Then west of it, you've suddenly got this slightly softly undulating landscape, which is where all the wadis are, this sort of veins on a leaf kind of river system that's scored these very sort of steep, narrow channels. And so when you're talking about a hill, you're talking about a rise in the ground that overlooks the Via Anzati.
Is it a hillock? Would we call it a hillock?
Well, sort of, but you know, one has a sort of mental image of a little sort of round sort of...
A pimple?
Pimple. So it's not as pronounced as that. It's a rise.
There we go! It's a rise. It's a rise. There we go. Yep. It's a rise. Yep.
But they move there only about 300 yards to the rear.
Yep.
And at this point, they've gone, he's only got 28 men left. He's got 28 men. He's got one water-cooled heavy machine gun, Browning machine gun, and his radio set. And he's still got this. And they bug back in darkness, you know, before it gets light, onto this little rise and dig in furiously in a kind of circle around this summit. And the weird thing is, throughout that whole day, the Germans just ignore them.
Really?
But just ignore them. I'm literally mystified. I've researched every single aspect of this to try and understand what the hell was going on. But there are no answers. It's going to just have to remain a mystery. They stay up in their hill and the Germans just ignore them. They just go around them. So they are completely cut off at this point.
But they have a radio, so he's spotting and he's sending artillery.
He absolutely is, as are the rest of the 2nd Battalion, which includes, of course, F and G companies. Who have scuttled back, and just west of the crossroads at Caracetto is the Buon Riposo Ridge, which is, again, it's pretty low. It's more a rise than a ridge. And but on the southern side of it, you've got all these caves. It suddenly drops away, and you've got these caves, and these are ancient Roman quarries. And they're huge. There's like 3 miles of caves under there. And then the most bizarre thing, there's like 4 entrances maybe, and you go in, and there's like a tunnel. And then there's little offshoots, there's little roads that go off. And then so it's like a labyrinth. It's like a sort of series of streets underneath. That's the only way I can describe it, really. It's really weird, really eerie in there.
Catacombs style.
Yeah, kinda. Yeah. But they're big. I mean, you know, it's like the ceilings are, you know, 15, 20 foot high, something like that. You know, so these are big cavities. It's really spooky in there, and there's still lots and lots of crap. It's got that horrible sort of damp, musty feel. And apparently, in recent years, they've been used as a kind of sort of mushroom farm. I mean, they're not anymore. They're just completely empty. But there's still lots of detritus from the battle. There's lots of sort of rusted bullets and stuff, kind of all around and things. They're really, really weird. Anyway, so G and F companies retreat into these caves underneath the Buon Riposo Ridge, while Company E, when Felix backs, is just sort of on this hill, isolated on this hill with his 28 men. But the Germans can't get into these caves because obviously it's really easy to defend the opening of a cave. And they just think, well, there's no point. Let's not waste time. This is all about momentum. Let's just keep going forward. And I think that's probably the reason why the guys on the hill are ignored. But, you know, and the guys in the cave, they can stay there as long as they like, but, you know, they're not going out. You know, once they run out of rations, they're stuffed. So we don't need to waste any time kind of getting bogged down with that. And I think that's what's going on.
That's a mistake, though. Has Lucas committed his armour because of his reluctance to commit his armour?
Not yet.
not bothered.
But on this second day, they really do, you know, the big push really kicks in, and actually the Lair Regiment kind of, you know, finds its chutzpah again. And is a bit more useful, and also you've got the second wave, which is the armour of 26th Panzer and 29th Panzer Grenadier divisions, also pushing down the Via Anzarte, and they do create this huge, great bulge, this salient in the Allied line, which is about 2 miles wide either side of the Via Anzarte, so a mile either side and about a mile deep, and that pushes them right back to the kind of beachhead line.
But here's the thing, though. You know, if an Allied salient is vulnerable, then a German salient is vulnerable, right? That this is your problem with your... We haven't used the word salient much on the podcast. I think it's quite good that we're giving your salients getting an airing.
Yeah, I agree.
If it's a salient, it tends to mean it's going to get smashed pieces and torn apart, isn't it? Right? Yeah. If it's a perimeter, then it's a doughty defence. What's the difference between a salient and a perimeter?
Well, a salient is a bulge, isn't it? It's a bulge or a dent.
At Arnhem, they talk about the used to be perimeter. It's a salient, lads. It's a salient.
It's a great big long finger that extends from the river up and to the
thumb-shaped thing that if you get cut off at the bottom, it's a salient. Or if they go through the middle, it's all flanks. It's all flanks.
Yeah. That's a really good. I love that.
So this is the thing. So the Germans, in an attempt to, because in a way, Anzio, the whole Anzio beachhead is a salient in its own sort of way. In an attempt to get rid of one salient, the Germans have created one of their own, which is, you know, a multiplication of problems, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because suddenly you've got three sides to defend, not one. But finally, Lucas commits his armour in the or some of it. In the afternoon of the 17th, by no stretch is it all of it, I should hasten to add. But he does commit a chunk of armour plus 4 90mm anti-aircraft batteries,
ooh,
which are there in a ground roll. Hooray, at long last. This is what we've all been screaming for absolutely ages. And there are two cruisers out at sea and massive weight of artillery fire onto the Germans, who are all kind of suddenly concentrated in this
salient.
The salient, and of course they get absolutely hammered. So by the end of by dusk on day two, the Allies are holding on, but literally only just. And then of course the problem is that the weather kicks in again, and you know it absolutely starts to pour with rain again. Day three and four, the Allies are holding on, but a number of British units are overrun. Your old friends, the 7th Battalion of the Ox and Bucks, they're on the top of the Buon Riposo Ridge, and the second 157th survivors who are now in these caves.
Yeah.
Sparks and Coe still fighting on their kind of Alamo Hill, down to 16 men. The London Irish, who we last saw on the Garigliano in kind of one of the opening episodes, but have now been moved up in part of 56th Division and been moved up into Anzio, they're trying to push up and trying to relieve the Ox and Bucks. And one of the guys that I've been writing about, a guy called John Strick. Do you remember I told you that guy, I sent you that thing from him from his hospital bed worrying about his nerves and stuff, and he's just been blown up in a patrol by some mines and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's in hospital. Okay, so well, he's just not fit for duty at all, but he gets sent back in the line. And on the 19th of, on the 18th rather of February, he is with the London Irish trying to find the Ox and Bucks. So they're at the edge of the Waddies, the northern edge of the Waddies, trying to find the isolated Ox and Bucks, who are now completely surrounded pretty much.
Yeah.
And trying to rescue them and try and cut a way through the German infantry. It's all incredibly confused. It's almost like kind of jungle warfare of the admin box. It's that kind of sort of vibe.
Yeah.
And he gets hit by a shell. He's completely obliterated. And that's him gone.
Christ.
It's really, really, really moving. But the amazing thing is that curiously on this day, on the 18th, the German renewing their attack, they then focus a little bit further eastwards, and they hit the 180th Infantry, yeah, rather than the 179th, which had been holding and the 157th, and they're in pretty good fettle, and so they're much better placed to withstand the German assault. And you've also got the British Loyals, who are from the 56th Division, who are manning the western side of the Via Anzarte, and again they just don't budge at all. That they hold that line. And by the morning of the 19th, you've got Allied bombing attacks because the weather then slightly improves again. They just absolutely hammer the command and control of the Germans in the rear. So comms to the German units, already bad because there's lots of orphan units and lots of different units who don't know one another, is made a whole load worse. And finally, you get this big, big armored counterattack by the 1st Armored Division, who are going down the bowling alley. And the bowling alley is a road, but it's a disused railway line. And it cuts across. So it comes from the kind of the southeast heading northwest. So it cuts across the Via Anzati. And you know that flyover, the lone flyover, which is that concrete flyover, which we talked about quite a bit on this part of the battleground, from the sort of Mussolini kind of new towns and all the rest of it. So it's just sat there in isolation. The bowling alley kind of sort of runs into that. And they use that as their axis. And the Germans just don't have any answer for this at all.
Right. Hey, Jim, I mean, that's an error by the Germans, isn't it, to attack fresh formations who haven't been tangling with up to this point. You know, they're smashing up all these battalions like 7th Ox and Bucks, and, you know, they should then go, all right, we'll shift to some people we haven't bothered with yet. Seems pretty daft. You know, they're 2-3 days into you know, combat themselves, so we're losing combat effectiveness as they go. And then to pick some new people to run into is a peculiar thing to do. I mean, one of the things here, the Allies are out firing the Germans 10 to 12 shells to one. I mean, you know.
Well, and that armoured assault by 1st Armoured is supported by 384 guns. Firing concentrations, which is always the key. It's not firing barrages, it's firing concentrations.
Yeah, 8 Royal Artillery Regiments.
Yeah. But you're firing concentrations rather. So just for those people who don't know, the difference between a concentration and a barrage is you're all firing forward and you've just got this sort of rain of fire coming down in a line. Whereas concentrations, you're getting all your guns to fire on one area of, say, 200 yards square.
Yeah.
So you've got a massive impact going, and then you move on to another concentration, then you move on to another concentration. So you're really saturating, you know, when you're firing concentrations, you're saturating the ground. And that's really good when you've got a lot of enemy troops massed in one area. And that's the problem of them using the Via Anzati as their main access. It means you've got too many troops in one concentrated area.
Well, but that's because they're trying to... This is the tangle, isn't it, between do you apply concentration of force in order to punch through? But if you do, you're concentrating, you're offering... You know, it's a conundrum, isn't it? That the quite clearly, I mean, perhaps if you had coherent units who all knew each other and trusted each other and knew what they were doing, that would be all right, but it ain't. I mean, if you can't answer 10 to 12 shells to one with counter-battery fire, there's no way of doing it, because the moment you do try any counter-battery fire, you're going to get counter-batteried yourself, aren't you? This is the problem of that imbalance from a German perspective, isn't it?
That's the truth of it. And it's interesting because the 14th Army, the German 14th Army War Diary goes, during the day, strong enemy counterattacks supported by tanks forced partial withdrawals from newly gained positions. And I love that line because it's just... It's like a euphemism for this battle's going absolutely nowhere. We're stuck.
Yeah, I mean, that is really partial withdrawals from newly gained positions. What you mean is this attack
is going absolutely nowhere.
This has all gone to shit.
So yeah, basically that night, Kesselring agrees that Fischfang is over. It's run its course. They've shot their bolt. They've got no more supplies they can send into it. You know, they haven't had the breakthrough. They've so close yet so far. But the battle does continue. Fighting continues as the Americans are trying to, and the Allies are trying to kind of secure this new line with the bulge. They don't eradicate the salient, but they are still desperately trying to get to these lost infantry battalions. So, I mean, this is the most amazing story. So the Queen's Own Royals do this charge in the middle of the night to try and get and find the 2nd 157th. Force their way to the caves, losing 76 men in the process, and then realize that they haven't got, you know, they've just got to stay in the caves because they're stuck there. So they made the breakthrough, but they can't make the break back, if you see what I mean. So they then get stuck, and it's not until the night of the 22nd that they get radioed, all the guys in the cave, plus to Felix Sparks, to try and make their way back. They're just going to have to kind of bay back out again overnight, just infiltrate your way through. And it's this amazing, I mean, just absolutely amazing, amazing operation. And 225 out of those two companies, F and G, do get back, which actually, in the big scheme of things, is more than one might imagine. But from Sparks's company, Easy Company, which started with 195 or whatever it was, only two men make it back.
Bloody hell!
The whole company has gone, completely gone. So, yeah, that's him and Platoon Sergeant Leon Sear and Felix Sparks.
So, the end of February, and it's a leap year, of course, so the 29th of February, Alex announces his plan to launch Operation Diadem, which is a major assault, two armies side by side, in April when the ground's harder. I mean, it's quite interesting to read that, isn't it? Because after all, we always think of the Eastern Front as you're waiting for the mud to dry out.
Major things happen at Fitchfang because Lucas gets sacked on the 23rd. It's over. They can all breathe a sigh of relief. They know that they're now not going to, you know, it's very, very unlikely that they're going to lose the salient, rather the bridgehead at Anzio. And what they say is, you know, everything's changed. This is now different. What we have proved, we haven't got to Rome, but what we are doing is we're drawing a hell of a lot of troops away from Normandy, which is inarguable. They absolutely are. They're saying what we need is we need to maintain our shipping. We need to continue to have at least six LSTs, landing ships, coming in every single day, which is what we're doing. We need to really, really build up Anzio now, because we need to, A, make sure that the Germans don't counterattack again, but B, that we use this as part of our spring offensive plans. And it is agreed in cahoots with Eisenhower and the Combined Chiefs of Staff that Italy will be the priority in the Mediterranean. And, you know, we can forget talk about Anvil for the moment. We'll just park that for now.
Yeah.
Italy is now the priority up and, you know, obviously Overlord is a priority, but outside of Overlord, Italy is now the priority. And we really, really want to make this work. And we can see why this is.
It's an end in itself.
This is an end in itself. And everything has changed with the end of Fitchfang. And it's this moment. So suddenly there is still pressure on time, but the pressure of time that was just absolutely just breaking everyone in Italy in January and February, that has now been parked because the situation has changed. And don't forget, when they were talking about Anvil, which is the proposed plan for the invasion of southern France, that was in December. And everything looked different. You know, it was a different plan for Operation Overlord. You know, Operation Overlord was actually quite small beer compared to what it became. There was an expectation of progress in Italy, which then didn't happen. The Germans hadn't responded to the campaign in Italy at this point. And the way that the Germans are funneling more and more troops into Italy is everything that they could possibly want. And so what General Wilson, who is the Supreme Allied Commander of the Mediterranean, is saying to the Chiefs of Staff in the last week of February is, look, the whole point about Anvil was to draw away German troops from Operation Overlord, but Italy's doing that. You just forget Anvil. It's a complete waste of time. And, you know, and also economies of scale, because everything's already here in Italy. Why do you want to then set up another front? And, you know, it's hard to argue. And the British Chiefs of Staff need to say are completely behind this. The Americans are like, yeah, but this is what you British always do, is always kind of sort of, you know, changing your mind. But you know, we agreed we were going to do Anvil and we don't want to change it.
Well, yes, old boy, but circumstances have changed.
But at the same time, but Eisenhower is saying, I'm not sure about Anvil anymore. And he was the big champion. So Anvil is just parked for the moment. But what is agreed is that they will increase the number of ships, and they will increase the tonnage going into Anzio from 2,500 tons a day, which can be guaranteed by the Navy, up to 4,000 tons. Yet again, there's another crisis of landing ships, but it does happen. And this is a big champ. But what they're doing now is they're thinking, right, okay, this phase of the campaign is over. It's now a new phase. And what we really want to do is wait for the ground to dry, wait till we can reorganize our troops, because in all this hurried fighting, all the rest of it, troops have got horribly mixed up. Fifth Army's become outsized. Eighth Army's languishing on the kind of Adriatic coast. Let's get both armies back side by side and do a major, concentrated, properly planned, properly prepared, none of this rush stuff anymore, attack in the spring, probably middle of April, something like that. Call it Operation Diadem. And we will also incorporate a breakout from Anzio as part of that battle plan. But in the meantime, let's also just see if we can turn the casino position give it one last go. So that's there. Whilst at the same time, insanely, Hitler and Kesselring urge von Mackensen to launch another attack at Anzio, and this is Operation Seitensprung.
What is it like being a German general?
We can finish this one quite quickly, and we'll finish off the episode with Seitensprung. So it's due to attack on the 26th of February. Again, von Mackensen wants to attack using the main roads coming from Cisterna in the middle of the bridgehead, rather than going down the Via Ranzati again. And Hitler goes, no, that's not the way to do it. You need to attack on the east, because that's where the ground is much better for the tanks. It's like, yeah, but a week ago you said it was much better on the Via Ranzati. So, and also the other thing is that running on the reason why the Germans up to this point haven't attacked in the east, on the eastern side of the bridgehead, is because Running north to south on the eastern barrier edge of it is the Mussolini Canal, and it then cuts west. So half of the bridgehead is covered by the Mussolini Canal, which has these huge flood banks either side of it. Some of them are 30 foot high, which is the perfect anti-tank defense. I mean, you know, and defensive barrier, in which, you know, it's like basically having a massive castellated wall. It's totally insane to suggest that this is where you should attack. But a brigade of a battalion of the 16th Waffen-SS Panzergrenadier Division attacks against the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment, who are based on this eastern side behind the Mussolini Canal, and they get absolutely cut to pieces. And there's this great account by Ross Carter, and he goes, "Only a minute or so passed before a tremendous volley of shells poured into the crowd heads like a waterspout. 48 guns, plus mortars and tank guns, dropped an arsenal into their ranks. A shell exploded in every 5 yards of the enemy formation. It seemed that not even a fly or a cockroach could survive in that hell of shrapnel." And they don't. They get slaughtered.
And they don't. And then, of course, von Mackensen is told to try again the next day.
I mean, and this is a repeat of, you know, the Sussex men trying to attack Point 593 and at Monte Cassino that we talked about in the last episode. It's like, it doesn't work. This is a terrible plan. It's not going to work on the first day when you've got the element of surprise and you've got all your assets. It's not going to work second time, and it doesn't. And then the weather clears up. Oh, this is the other thing, is that they were going to launch on the kind of 26th and they can't because it pours of rain. It's absolute torrential rain. So the whole ground is waterlogged. So the whole idea of sending an armoured attack across this open ground is just insane anyway. It's never going to work. And then it clears up on the second, which is still no good for tanks because obviously the residual effects of waterlogged ground don't just clear up with a little bit of sunshine. But it's fantastic for air power. And heavy bombers come over and hammer them. And then there's 175 Yarbos, these are fighter bombers, sweep in, then 260 in the next sweep, and they just get absolutely hammered. And Seitensprung costs 3,000 casualties for absolutely no gain whatsoever. And just to put that in some perspective, that is substantially worse than the combined losses of the 34th Red Bulls and the 4th Indian Division on Monte Cassino.
If we want to point a comparison.
So the Germans do go onto the defence on the 4th of March. At Anzio, and you know, by the 13th of March, there are 7,660 British and 13,536 US vehicles in the Anzio bridgehead, not including 2,042 tanks.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, what are you waiting for? I mean, obviously, better weather, basically.
You're waiting for better weather. That's the issue. It's you can't do this.
But the enemy gets a vote, but the weather has the casting vote, is the truth. You know, if there's...
Yes, I think that is true.
If there's three parties if it's best of three, the enemy gets the vote, the weather gets the... But the weather has the casting vote. If the weather's against you, it doesn't matter who you are or how many vehicles or tanks you've got. If you can't go forward, you can't go forward. If you can't see... Anyway,
so on that cliffhanger, the next episode, our attention returns back to Cassino.
Imagine that.
Operation Dickens.
Operation Dick. I mean, what a terrible name. Anyway, we will see you in our next episode for Operation Dickens. I mean, maybe do we call the next episode what? The Dickens? I don't know.
Or do we just call it the Third Battle of Cassino?
I think we call it Third Battle of Cassino. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. If you've enjoyed this, subscribe to our Apple podcast channel where you don't need to listen to the adverts if you really want to rush on. And you can hear this whole thing in one go because we still don't know how many episodes this is yet. the only way for you to find out is to listen to all of them.
It's looking like about 12, isn't it?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
What have we done so far? Is that five?
That was five. That was five, James. And if this is your cup of tea, this kind of waffle, join our Patreon, War Waffle, where you'll find like-minded afflicted souls, afflicted with an interest in the Second World War. And even better, why not come to our festival? We have Ways Fest on the 18th to the 21st of July at Black Pit Brewery next door to Silverstone Racetrack, just off the M40, where a whole weekend of this kind of thing, and you could come right up to Jim and say, "Was there no way you could have contained that in three episodes?" And he'll look you dead in the eye and go, "No, I wanted to do 30 episodes on Cassino, but they wouldn't let
me." And I got cut back to six, eight.
It's gonna be eight or nine. Anyway, thanks for listening. We will see you again very soon with Cassino! ! What the Dickens! ...
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.